Welcome to Smart Talk. I'm Scott Lamar, broadcasting from my home studio. Coming up later in the program, is banning President Trump from social media an infringement on free speech? And also, can an employer require an employee to get the COVID-19 vaccination? But up front, the FBI is saying armed protests are being planned in all 50 state capitals this weekend, and maybe up until President-elect Joe Biden is inaugurated Wednesday. This comes a week after a violent insurrection at the U.S. Capitol in Washington that left 5 people dead and Trump impeached for a second time for allegedly inciting the protesters. As he has done since the November election, the president baselessly claimed that there was rampant fraud and the election was stolen from him. Preparations are being made in Harrisburg for any protest that may occur, and maybe even in some other cities around the state. Joining us today, two reporters for WITF who have covered this issue in the last few days, WITF reporter Sam Dunklaw and Anthony Orozco. Gentlemen, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having us, Scott.
Good morning.
If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at @SmartTalkWITF. Again, the phone number, 1-800-729-7532. Sam Dunklaw, let me start with you. The Capitol is your beat. Do we know that there will be protest at the Capitol this weekend for sure?
We don't know for sure, Scott, but we have a pretty good idea. At least that's what law enforcement has been telling us. So when we started our reporting this week, both Capitol Police and State Police were being pretty vague with their preparations. They were being vague even about the intelligence they were receiving in terms of what protests may converge on Harrisburg in the coming days. But yesterday, those same officials held a presser telling us all that they are looking at January 17th as the main date, mostly because of the online proliferation of that date in armed calls for armed protests at all 50 state capitals. So they're looking at that date. They're not exactly, nobody's really exactly sure what will materialize, how many people will be there. Whether or not they indeed will be armed, but police, it appears, are not really taking any chances.
When we talk about armed protests, this may surprise some people that it is legal for people who are protesting to bear arms, that they can come with a rifle, they can come with a handgun. I mean, what's the law say? Or, maybe you can talk a little bit about that it is not against the law. Are there certain places where a protester can't go when they are armed?
That's unclear. I mean, at least police did not make that immediately clear in terms of whether or not they will prevent anybody who's armed from stepping onto the Capitol grounds, for instance. The law has specific prohibitions and regulations in terms of concealed carry, but the law is in fact silent, or at least state law is silent on open carry. So you can effectively open carry in Pennsylvania, but you need a permit for concealed carry. Now, the governor has extended concealed carry permits for those that have expired within the last year through mid-March. So a fair amount of folks who have already have their concealed carry permit will be able to probably do so if they show up at the Capitol. Both Harrisburg City Police and the Capitol Police have they expressed favor for those individuals when they've showed up in the past for Second Amendment marches and in other places in the past year. They said that they've largely been orderly, that they haven't caused any trouble. So they're hoping that the same thing will be true this time around, but the dynamic, Scott, is quite a bit different than then.
Sam, what precautions have been taken at the Capitol?
So right off the bat, Capitol Police have been telling us all week that there are special resource team officers. These officers that are heavily armed, that have long guns. They are at the Capitol. They are making themselves visibly known. You've probably seen pictures of them at various news outlets all throughout the week. That is a very clear demonstration that the Capitol Police are taking any potential threats very seriously. On top of that, the state police are offering quite a number of resources. The deputy director of operations had talked about the idea of using mounted police, the idea that aerial support in various forms may be deployed. We're talking drones, helicopters. A bomb squad is said to be on site, or is going to be on site throughout the next couple of days. And putting this all together, the governor himself has offered a pretty large show of force for the Capitol in deploying 450 National Guard troops to be staged in and around the Capitol to, at very minimum, keep the complex safe and keep any demonstrations very, very clearly within those peaceful lines.
So, Anthony, you have been in contact with Harrisburg Police and some police departments around the state, but let's talk about the Harrisburg Police in particular, because there's the possibility that it would not just be the Capitol. If there was any kind of insurrection or any kind of violence, that it could be in the surrounding area. What did you hear from Harrisburg Police in their preparations?
What I heard from Harrisburg Police is that they are taking the stance that they respect people's First Amendment right to assemble and to protest. And a lot of their comments were along those lines. It did not seem that they were on any sort of heightened awareness or, on pins and needles about what may happen. In fact, the sergeant that I spoke to there said, you know, we had a ton of different protests in 2020, and it seemed like they weren't seeing this as any different from what we had seen over the summer.
Really? I mean, even though there was violence at the U.S. Capitol last week, and that, you know, the FBI, it's not often the FBI gets involved in this and makes warnings like they have at all 50 state capitals. But you say that at least publicly, Harrisburg Police seem to be taking this as just another protest.
That's the information that I got. And it seems like of the eight different cities and boroughs that I contacted, one, comments were pretty brief among police. One, they don't want to tip their hand about the strategy that they're taking for these possible protests that may turn out to be more. But also, they just kept it to First Amendment rights. They will show up. And they're trying to stay apprised of any developments that they're working with other law enforcement partners to make sure that they are aware of any threats. But currently, they say that they are not aware of any active threats of violence in the city.
You know, it was something you mentioned about other places around the state. Often, Pennsylvania's largest city, Philadelphia, when there is any kind of issue to protest, that's usually where it occurs. Do we know whether any of these other places expect anything, or, I mean, you just kind of touched on this, of preparations that are being made, but the FBI specifically talked about state capitals, but do we know of other cities around the state that may be where there may be protest?
Yeah, so I spoke with places like Philadelphia, Gettysburg. We saw some action over the summer. Chambersburg, Harrisburg, of course, as you mentioned, Allentown, Lebanon, and Lancaster. And the one common thread between all of them was that they are not aware of any active threats of violence, that they are monitoring the situation, and that they're going to be working with law enforcement partners. It almost seemed like all of them had the same statement to a certain extent, but it does not seem like any of them are in sort of any sort of heightened awareness or nervousness about what may come.
Sam, the Capitol being your beat, I don't know whether you've observed, and Anthony, I don't know whether you can answer this or not, but I have heard some rumor, and I don't know whether it's rumor or not, probably people can tell us for sure, that some businesses, that some homes around the Capitol, that people themselves are taking the precautions, maybe boarding up windows. Is that true? Has that happened?
Not that I personally have witnessed, Scott. I can say for sure that two Harrisburg City libraries had announced late yesterday that they would be boarding up very soon. And then that later in the week, Saturday, that is specifically, they would close. And that a decision to reopen would then be determined later in the week, depending on what's happening in the city. That's just one public example of what some establishments around Harrisburg are doing to prepare for this. It would not surprise me if folks are doing that. I just personally have not witnessed that.
I have not witnessed anything of that sort, but I think Sam touched on something earlier this week in a report about people arming themselves. You know, we may not see people boarding up homes, or at least, you know, as of yet, but there are certainly statistics out there that show that people are arming themselves more. They're buying more ammo. It's hard to come across very common types of ammunition. And this is something that I came across in the summer during the height of the racial reckoning that the United States went through, and seeing protesters open carry, conceal carry, and also militiamen show up to protest. So if we don't see it in the protecting of property, I'm sure that people are protecting their person.
Yeah, and just to piggyback off that, Scott, I mean, the state police just in the last 3 months have conducted 420,000 background checks, a record for them. One gun shop that we spoke to in Harrisburg said that he had done double the amount of business, sold $20,000 worth of firearms and ammunition just in the last week, given what's going on. So that, again, as Anthony had said, kind of paints the picture for you.
Yeah, and we don't want to make it sound like the purchase of firearms, people arming themselves, is directly related to the events of last week. But obviously, during this pandemic, there are a lot of people who have decided that they need to protect themselves. As Anthony said, I mean, I think you can make a direct correlation between, you know, the racial reckoning protest of the summer and more people going out and buying firearms. And as Sam said, just here in the last week, Sam, often plans for these protests are known well ahead of time because the protesters get permits or they let someone know. I mean, they want the idea behind a protest for the most part is to bring attention to your cause. But that hasn't been the case here. There haven't been permits issued, correct?
That's right. We spoke with both the Capitol Police and with Harrisburg Public Works Department in terms of whether or not anybody's applied for permits, and nobody has. That process usually does take a little bit of time. There's a formality that goes with it, but there's nothing in the official channels. And as it's been reported, it's hard to really gauge where folks who might be organizing this are coming from, because they're on these end-to-end encrypted services like Signal and Telegram. They've been kicked off of the large social media platforms for the most part. So it's been difficult to determine whether or not they are in fact contacting each other and are organizing, but just simply out of sight.
Yeah, that's one of the ironies of so many people being banned from social media. In our next segment, we're going to be talking about President Trump, but there have been 70,000 that have been banned after the insurrection last week. And as you said, Sam, it has made it more difficult for law enforcement to know what plans are in the pipeline, and they've kind of gone underground, which is scary in itself. In that these plans are not being made public, so no one quite knows what to expect. So preparations are being made big time, as you've described. So why Sunday? Sam, do we know any reason why Sunday has been pinpointed as a day of these protests across the country?
We really don't, or at least the reporting that we've done, we haven't really been able to uncover that, and officials really haven't given us a clue as to why they think that that data is big. From what I've been able to dig up and around, the only thing that I can really extrapolate is that that's just simply the date that a lot of these online flyers have stuck to. These online flyers were initially distributed in places like Parler before Amazon Web Services kicked them off. But now they're being proliferated on very rudimentary message boards, places like the Donald.win. There's a number of posts that have been up in the last week that have indicated that armed protests may be happening specifically on January 17th. So if I were to guess, I would say that law enforcement are seeing those same posts, and that because that's been the common date, that's the one that they're zeroing in on. It's unclear to me, at least at this point, why that date has any significance, but that seems to be what potential demonstrators are going for.
And even though Sunday is the day that many of these protests have been supposedly planned, there are states around the country, including here in Pennsylvania, where precautions have been taken. Governor Wolf announced yesterday that now Monday's a holiday, so there won't be state workers there at the Capitol anyway. But the Tuesday and Wednesday, Sam, what did the governor ask of employees?
You know, Scott, I hadn't had a chance to zero in on that, but I know that additional precautions are being taken at the Capitol.
Well, what the governor basically said late yesterday afternoon is that he wanted those who work at the Capitol to take Tuesday and Wednesday off as well. So there won't be as many people at the Capitol, even leading up to the inauguration of President-elect Biden, up until Wednesday. WITF reporter Sam Dunklaw and Anthony Orozco, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks so much, Scott.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Coming up on Monday Smart Talk, it is Martin Luther King Day, and we'll be talking about racial injustice and what's occurred over the past 6 months. And probably Martin Luther King Day is a good day to look back over those last 6 months and see if any progress has been made, what changes have been made. That's our discussion on Monday Smart Talk. Twitter CEO Jack Dorsey defended his company's ban of President Donald Trump's Twitter account by saying the risk to public safety created an extraordinary and untenable circumstance for the company, essentially leaving them no choice. Conservative groups are crying foul over the social media cancellations, saying the actions are an infringement of free speech. But are they? Joining us is Robert D. Richards. He is the John and Ann Curley Professor of First Amendment Studies and founding director of the Pennsylvania Center for the First Amendment at Penn State University. Dr. Richards, thank you very much for being with us today.
Thanks for having me, Scott. Good to be here.
So I'll ask this question right up front. Is removing President Trump and some 70,000 other accounts a First Amendment violation of freedom of speech?
No, it isn't. And that's something that I think everybody needs to step back and understand when we, you know, everybody is very quick to wave the First Amendment flag when they feel that their free speech rights have been violated. The First Amendment is very, very specific. It says that government shall not violate your speech. There has to be some type of government action in order to have a First Amendment infringement. Jack Dorsey and Twitter or Facebook or any social media platform is not a platform of government. It is a private entity. As such, a private entity could stop someone's speech. You know, if I owned a radio station and I put you on my station, Scott, and along, you know, a few months into it, I don't want you on there anymore, and I fire you, you can't sue me and make a First Amendment challenge. I'm a private entity. So you need a government actor.
What does the First Amendment say? I mean, you've touched on it, but specifically, what does the First Amendment say about free speech?
Well, the First Amendment is only 45 words long, and the first couple of clauses of the First Amendment deal with freedom of religion, both the establishment of it and the free exercise thereof it. And then it says the government, it says Congress, but it has been through Supreme Court cases applied to the government generally. The government cannot abridge your freedom of speech or freedom of the press. And the rest of it deals with the right of assembly and the right to petition your government for redress. So the few words of the First Amendment had to be interpreted, over the last couple of centuries. And it's been interpreted many times by the Supreme Court, other courts as well, but, you know, primarily the final arbiter being the U.S. Supreme Court. So basically what it does is it gives us rights. Remember, it's in the Bill of Rights. It's a liberty that we have as citizens that you can't have your speech summarily suppressed by the government. That's what it was there for. It was there to give citizens the right to speak. Now, again, a lot of people forget that when they're talking about social media or maybe even talking about the general media, mainstream media, and they think, well, First Amendment rights are being violated. Not unless the government is stepping in and violating it. That's the only way you can have a First Amendment challenge. It just gives you the rights under the Bill of Rights to speak out, to speak your mind, and be free of government repression of that speech.
By the way, I want to tell our listeners that if you have a question or a comment during this part of the program, talking about the First Amendment, social media, President Trump, the 70,000 other accounts that have been dropped or banned because they have mentioned some violence or maybe inciting of violence, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. All right, so these social media companies, they are private companies, but let's face it, they're different than many other companies or many other forms of communication in the past. I mean, when you look at Facebook that has billions of, I don't know if it's billions, but at least a billion users across the world, when that gives them enormous power. And for them to say, okay, you're banned, the speech you've been making is unacceptable, we're not going to allow you on here, doesn't that give them tremendous power over someone's speech?
Sure, it gives them power because they, you know, obviously it's a platform that people are using. It's a platform people are using to express themselves, you know, every day, throughout the day, and that certainly does give them a lot of power. It also gives them a lot of responsibility, at least from my perspective, responsibility to make sure that their platforms are being used in a proper fashion. And if their platforms are being used in the commission of a crime, for example, then that's a problem. And in this particular instance that we're talking about, there was a concern that the platform, Twitter, was being used to promulgate an insurrection or certainly to spur on people who are bad actors to do some bad things. And so Twitter decided that, hey, we have to make a business decision here. Do we want our platform being used for these nefarious purposes? And they made the decision that they did not want to. So they decided that, hey, maybe we ought to take some people off of it. Maybe some will be banned permanently, maybe not. Maybe they'll allow people back in when the temperature of the country sort of goes down a bit in terms of the politics. And I think that's well within their rights to do that. Now, of course, you know, they're not, you know, charitable institutions, Facebook and Twitter and the like. They are there to make money. And one of the ways they make money is by putting amalgams together of different types of people and then being able to, you know, check, sell that to advertisers and so forth. So, you know, they're not just charitable institutions out there. They're there to make a buck, and there's nothing wrong with that. And that's what they're trying to do. Now, there's going to be a lot of talk, I think, after we get over the next couple of weeks to decide whether or not Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, these social media platforms should be policing their postings a lot more carefully. And I think that's going to be a discussion that's going to have to take place. It's probably going to take place in Congress. It's going to take place in the boardrooms of these organizations. And they're going to have to come up with some new policies. But remember, it's a contractual thing. If I want to join Twitter, I want to join Facebook, I go in and I click that I have agreed to the terms of service. Now, you know, Scott, you and I know that most people click those things and don't read them. But I think they're going to have to be reading them in the future, because there's going to be a lot of stuff in those terms of service that you are agreeing to. If you decide you want to use this platform and post your pictures on it or post your messages on it, you're going to have to make sure in the future that you read those terms of service to see exactly what that contractual relationship is between the social media entity and yourself.
With President Trump in particular, now there are people criticizing, some people that are criticizing the social media company, as Twitter in particular, for banning the president from their platforms. But before, there were people who were criticizing the social media companies, but especially Twitter, for giving President Trump too much leeway. That because he was the president of the United States, they give him a little more rope than what they would say you or I. What about that? Did you see that? Or, I mean, are there roles for different people?
Well, in a way, Twitter has to thank President Trump for sort of saving it. Before Trump entered the scene to run for president, Twitter was not sort of the social media of choice. It was, it was sort of waning in terms of its, people being interested in it. President Trump jumping onto Twitter and using it as his primary form of communication to the country certainly brought Twitter back into its own. So I think in that sense, Twitter wanted to give him as much leeway as possible. And let's face it, if the president of the United States is using your service, that's pretty good advertising for you, right? That's going to get a lot of people interested in your company and interested in your product, your social media platform. So I think it was kind of a win-win situation for Twitter and for President Trump. Now, as President Trump sort of entered into this latest phase of his career as a president, things started to change a little bit. And I think, I think that Jack Dorsey and Twitter decided that, we cannot allow our service to stoke insurrection. And they were afraid that some of the messages that were being sent to even some of the people, the rioters around the Capitol, were happening in real time. And I think they stepped back and decided that they really needed to change that.
We have an email here from a listener who wants to know, what about if the government allows social media companies to have unfettered control and essentially monopolies? Can a line be drawn to the First Amendment?
Well, I'm not so sure you could say they are monopolies. I mean, it's not one company that's controlling everything. I mean, that may happen at some point. But, I mean, I think there are several different types of social media platforms. And my guess is there's going to be more of them coming forward in the future, that you're going to have, more opportunities to get your message out there. Again, in order to raise a First Amendment challenge, you have to have the government acting. And when you have a private company acting, that's not the government. So it's you can talk about free speech and free speech in companies. That's fine. But in terms of, raising a First Amendment issue, without that nexus, without that connection to government, without some type of a state or federal government, local government actor, you don't have a First Amendment challenge at all.
Another question from a listener, and I was wondering how long it would take before someone studied this, but Trump's behavior is similar to shouting fire in a crowd, which the Supreme Court has ruled is not protected. Is it?
It's interesting. Everybody knows that line from the 1919 case of Schenck versus United States, when Oliver Wendell Holmes wrote, "You can't shout fire in a crowded theater." They don't know the rest of the line, which is, unless there's a fire, you can't create panic necessarily. You can shout fire in a crowded theater if there's a fire. In fact, I would encourage it. So, in this particular instance, I think that the caller is talking about, they're concerned that what President Trump said on Twitter, and maybe what some others, not just him, have said on Twitter, is the type of language that in the circumstances that are being used would create a clear and present danger. That is actually the test that came out of that case that Oliver Wendell Holmes uttered, that very famous line. The update of that case came in 1969 at the U.S. Supreme Court in a case called Brandenburg versus Ohio. And in that particular case, the test became that if your speech is directed to advocating imminent lawless action, and as a second part to the test, and it is likely to produce such action, then the speech can be punishable. Then the speech loses First Amendment protection. So if I'm going to use an example here that maybe the listeners won't like, maybe they will like, but I mean, let's take Rudy Giuliani's speech the other day. Let's take President Trump out of it for just a moment, because right now he couldn't be charged with a crime anyway while he's a sitting president. But Rudy Giuliani is a private citizen. Rudy Giuliani gets up at this event and says, you know, we should engage in trial by combat. Those particular words. Now, we look at those words used, we look at the circumstances they're being used in, and the circumstances they're being used in is you have a crowd of people there who are your supporters, who are there to try to keep the president in office. You're kind of exhorting them to go down the street, which is all in walking distance to the U.S. Capitol, and engage in trial by combat. Now, the word combat, general definitions applied, the word combat means engaging in some type of armed conflict. That is exactly what happened. So you have his speech, you have a group of people being directed to do something, and that group of people are folks who are kind of predisposed to doing this. So if you apply the Brandenburg test, is he advocating imminent lawless action? Well, it's imminent because it's right down the street and Congress was meeting at the moment. Is it likely to produce that action? Arguably, it is, because you have that group of people who are predisposed to doing that type of activity and indeed did do that activity. So, I mean, there's, an issue, a criminal liability issue for someone like Giuliani and maybe even Mo Brooks, who stood up at that same rally and, you know, basically told people to go down the street and engage in some type of violent conduct.
You know, one of the questions I'm seeing here from listeners, if I could read between the lines, is basically they're asking, who decides, though? I mean, you stated that these are private companies and they make their own decisions. I guess what the listeners are asking is there more transparency needed here? And, you know, conservatives have long complained that the social media companies are more liable to, you know, put up warning that, you know, this speech has, you know, that it's not factual or whatever, to conservative statements rather than those of on the other side who disagree with them. So what kind of transparency is there? And I mean, this is something that when you talk about the First Amendment, has to be the government involved some way. Could the government get more involved in how social media platforms make decisions?
Well, it's an excellent question, and I mean, your listeners are right on point when they're looking at the transparency of the organization. We don't know really what happens at Twitter or Facebook or any of the other social media platforms to make that decision to put the flag up there that says, you know, a disclaimer saying that this may not be true or this isn't true or there's other you know, other information out there, that sort of thing. I think transparency is a good thing. I think it's good for the company, it's good for the country, and I think we're going to see more of it. There's going to be a lot of soul searching once we get past this, you know, next couple of weeks. And I think a lot of soul searching at these companies themselves. Every time Congress brings the CEO, Zuckerberg or Dorsey or whoever, to Washington to face, you know, a day of questioning, which, you know, may not be so much fun for them. It's a message. It's sort of almost a tacit understanding that, you know, if you guys don't kind of clean up your act, we might have to step in and do some things to do it for you. That's always a little tricky, because if the government, if the Congress were to create laws and the president signed them into law that, you know, impinges upon those companies' rights of free speech, then there is a First Amendment issue, and that would have to be litigated in the courts. But I think that's not going to happen. I think what's going to happen is these companies are going to realize that, you know, we need to clean up our act. We need to get more transparent. We need to sort of bring back into our fold the country the citizens of our country, our users, and make them feel comfortable using the platform, make it look as though we are socially responsible in actually looking at our postings. I think you're going to see more of that. I think they're going to look more carefully into what's being posted on these sites in the coming weeks and months. And I think you're going to see some changes with respect to that. Again, for your audience, I would say, I would alert you, make sure you look at the terms of service. If you get a ping from Facebook or Twitter saying, we've promulgated some new terms of service, I would really encourage you to take a look at those.
Robert Richards is the John and Ann Curley Professor of First Amendment Studies and Founding Director of the Pennsylvania Center for the First Amendment at Penn State University. Thank you very much for being with us today.
Thank you.
You're listening to Smart Talk on WITF, your home for NPR News and all things regional. I'm Scott Lamar. Welcome back to Smart Talk. The long-awaited COVID-19 vaccine distribution plan is underway around the country and in Pennsylvania. Maybe not as quick as what we would like, but it is. Health officials have said that any American who wants a vaccine will be able to get one by early summer. There are certainly some people who, though, offered a vaccine, will choose not to take it. But what if you don't want a COVID-19 vaccine or object to it for some other reason? Can your employer or even a travel provider require you to take it? Is it possible in the future that you might be refused service for not being vaccinated against the coronavirus? These are all questions that have arisen even lately. City of Harrisburg Mayor Papenfuss has said that he wants all city employees to get the coronavirus vaccine. So it is just this week here in our own backyard this question is being approached. Joining us now is attorney Andrew Levy. He was with the law firm of McNeese, Wallace, and Nurek, LLC. Mr. Levy, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me.
If you have a question or comment, I'm sure there are people who have questions about this. 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at SmartTalkWITF. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. So I'll ask the big question right off the bat, Andrew Levy. If my employer says I must be vaccinated and I don't want to get the vaccination, can they force me to do it?
The answer is probably yes. Like the coronavirus, these questions are novel questions, right? So we don't have court decisions. These issues haven't made their way through the courts, but the guidance that's available would indicate that yes, an employer has the right to mandate the vaccine. The EEOC has come out in December and issued guidance, the EEOC enforces in the U.S. The anti-discrimination laws, so the Americans with Disabilities Act, Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, among them. And the EEOC has taken the position that a mandatory vaccination policy would not violate the ADA or Title VII of the Civil Rights Act, but that employers may have to go through a process of considering whether a reasonable accommodation could be offered to people who could show that they cannot take the vaccine because of a disability or because of sincerely held religious beliefs.
Now, that EEC, is that right? EEC, it's Equal Employment Opportunity, EEO, right?
EEOC, yes.
The right,
Equal
okay.
Employment Opportunity okay. Commission, yes.
Was that referring directly or specifically about coronavirus, or was it other vaccines or other things that employers were requiring of employees?
So the guidance that was issued in December by the EEOC related specifically to COVID-19 vaccines.
Okay.
The EEOC had previously opined in a similar manner about mandatory flu vaccination, but the guidance that was issued in December related specifically to COVID-19.
So if we're to take that one step further, if an employer says an employee must be vaccinated and they refuse, then the employer could fire that employee. Is that correct?
It is correct, unless the employee could show that they were unable to take the vaccine because of a disability. And really, that's probably going to be limited to a history of severe allergic reaction to an ingredient in the vaccine, or because of a sincerely held religious belief. Mm-hmm. And if that were the case, then the employer would need to at least consider whether a reasonable accommodation might be available. So in that context, a reasonable accommodation might be working remotely if the employee could work remotely consistent with their job duties. But if the employer, you know, even in the case of a disability or a sincerely held religious belief, the EEOC notes that if the employer considers reasonable accommodation and gets through that process and concludes that without the vaccine, the employee would pose a direct threat to other coworkers or to members of the public that they interact with in the workplace, then that individual could be excluded from the workplace. I do think that many employers, even those that mandate, may end up in those cases where a disability or a sincerely held religious belief exists, may end up excluding the person from the workplace rather than outright terminating the employment relationship. And that would look like an extended unpaid leave of absence until such time as the pandemic is declared to be over.
Well, that's if, put it this way, everyone is different. Every employer is different, so they may react in a different way. Isn't the key to what you said that the EEOC ruled, the key is that the employee poses a threat to their colleagues, and that, I don't know if it supersedes, but that is more important than maybe their individual right to say, I don't want this vaccine.
That's right. First of all, it's important to note that we don't get into the analysis unless the reason for objecting is a sincerely held religious belief or a disability. But if we do get into the reasonable accommodation analysis, an employer has an obligation to make a reasonable accommodation, but not if it would impose an undue hardship. And an accommodation that would involve a direct threat to safety would be an undue hardship. So that does trump, essentially, as you mentioned, the obligation to accommodate the employee.
If you're just tuning in here in the last few minutes of the program, our guest is attorney Andrew Levy with the law firm of McNeese, Wallace, and Newark, LLC. We're talking about whether an employer can require an employee to get the COVID-19 vaccine. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 1-800-729-7532. Send an email to smarttalk@witf.org. On Twitter, we are at smarttalkwitf. Again, that phone number, 1-800-729-7532. And if you do have a question or comment, I encourage you to make that call now because we only have 7 or 8 minutes left in the program. Here's a question from a listener. Is a requirement by your employer to get the vaccine any different than schools requiring vaccines before you attend?
It's not much different. I would argue that in some ways it's less restrictive, right? Because especially when we're talking about private employers, aren't providing education, which is kind of more of a right than a right to a private job. So from the private employer's perspective, I don't think it's a whole lot different, and perhaps in some ways less restrictive than when schools mandate vaccination for children who would be attending.
You know, I know that you can't speculate on what laws may be in place in the future, but I'm just kind of wondering out loud here, whether in the future, once the current pandemic is under control, whether this would become the COVID-19 vaccine would become part of a regular vaccination for school children, for workers, whether that's something coming down the road.
It is hard to predict weeks ahead, let alone months or years, with respect to this virus. But I agree that that's certainly quite possible. depending upon the course that the virus takes. We see many employers now who are grappling with the question as to whether to mandate or whether to strongly recommend the vaccine. And many are strongly recommending, some are mandating. And among those that are strongly recommending, many are offering some form of incentive for employees to get the vaccine when they're eligible and to provide proof of vaccination. Another very interesting issue that's going to develop as we get to the point where the pandemic's not quite under control, but many people have been vaccinated, is, you know, what kind of restrictions and what kind of mitigation measures are going to apply to those who've received the vaccine as compared to those who haven't. So it's going to be very important for employers to at least encourage all of their employees to get vaccinated as soon as possible and to know which employees have been vaccinated and which have not. And the EEOC also clarified that employers are within their rights to require employees to inform the employer when they've been vaccinated and to provide proof of vaccination.
We have a caller, Art, from Harrisburg. So he heard on our station, WITF, yesterday, and I'm assuming this is an NPR story, said that an employer cannot mandate the vaccine while it's only under emergency approval, that it needs full approval first. Is that correct? I mean, that would seem to go against the EEOC ruling.
Well, that's a very interesting argument that's out there in some of the commentary. And it's true that the vaccine has received emergency use authorization. And according to the FDA, that means that when the vaccine's administered by the provider, that the person who's receiving it has to be given a fact sheet. And that fact sheet indicates that the employee is told that they have the option to accept or refuse the vaccine and the consequences, if any, of refusing. But that's a requirement of the FDA and the provider. It's not a requirement that would necessarily limit the rights of the rights and restrictions on a private employer. Some have opined that since that emergency use authorization exists, that a wrongful discharge cause of action could be brought by an employee if they're fired for not getting the vaccine. And we'll have to see how those issues play out in the courts. I think in Pennsylvania, that's going to be a very difficult cause of action to make out because our Supreme Court has noted that the only grounds or the only sources of public policy that can support a wrongful discharge cause of action have to be drawn from our state laws or constitution or regulation, not from federal sources such as the FDA.
Mm-hmm. You know, I think what we're talking about when we're discussing whether an employee can be required to become vaccinated may also apply to mask, for example. Could an employee or can an employer, require, require an employee to wear a mask while on the job?
Yeah, and the answer to that question is pretty clearly yes. The EEOC has made that clear, and mandatory mask wearing is a requirement in Pennsylvania. Many employers are enforcing that, and I think the answer to that question is yes. And the arguments on the other side of that question are less significant, in my opinion, as those which exist with respect to mandatory vaccination.
I don't know whether you can answer this or not, because we've been talking about the employer-employee relations and what's allowed and what's not. But in my introduction, I talked about when you want to travel on an airplane, if you don't have a card that says you've been vaccinated, would airlines be able to say, nope, can't ride with us?
Sure. And I am a labor and employment lawyer here at McNeese Wallace and Erck, so that's my focus area. But I do think that the airlines would have significant latitude in imposing that requirement. they also may have an obligation to consider whether a reasonable accommodation could be made if a passenger said that they have not been vaccinated, but the reason why is because they have a disability or a severe allergic reaction to one of the ingredients. So I do think in general terms that the airlines or other service providers are going to have that flexibility.
Andrew Levy with the law firm of McNeese, Wallace & Nurick, LLC. Hey, thank you very much. A lot to think about. I'm Scott Lamar. Have yourself a good weekend.